Okay, if everyone could take their seats, please. Thank you very much. Just a brief announcement for this session. Unfortunately, I got word from Dr. Feuerstein that he will not be able to attend today. But we're still really pleased to be joined for this session on how sort of relationships between the Dati Lumi community and the secular public, if we can use such easy binary dichotomies. It's probably a lot more complicated than that. So the two gentlemen on the far end you met this morning, Professor Kapel, who teaches at Bar-Ilan, Rabbi Nataf, who's a Jerusalem-based educator. It's my pleasure now to introduce to you Rabbi Yuval Shurlo, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Hezder Petach Tikva, and is the co-founder of the Tzohar Rabbinical Organization. Please give our panel a hand. Okay. I've actually asked Rabbi Shurlo this question in Toronto. I'm going to ask you again, because new context, so we'll see how it goes here. Just after the Hitnat Kud in 2005, you wrote a few months later the following, and I want you to think about it in this context for this panel. You wrote, "In Israel today, we hear two totally different narratives about the destruction of Gush Katif. The difference is already evident in the name. We religious Zionists call what happened destruction, expulsion, uprooting. And we call it racist transfer. An absolute majority of the secular public, however, refer to it as disengagement. We regard the expulsion as a traumatic event whose reverberations will never be forgotten or forgiven, while for the other sector, it was an insignificant event no longer on the agenda. We see it as an act of dictatorship, tantamount to the usurpation of government by corrupt underhand means, but an entire sector of the public sees it as a legal democratic act, perhaps crooked, but such are the ways of democracy. We feel that our disproportionate contribution to the army and elsewhere has gone unrecognized and earned us no gratitude. Others feel that we have trampled everything that they value and hold sacred. These two narratives are the real threat to the state of Israel. That each side is immersed in its own narrative without understanding that of the other side clearly heralds an imminent rupture." Unquote. So I'd like to begin, Rav Shurlo, with two questions. One of them is whether you feel still now, almost 7 years later, that this rupture could take place, is taking place, and so on. Whether you feel the situation has changed since you wrote those words 7 years ago, and how you would characterize, in general terms, the relationship between the Dati Lumi sector of society and the Chiloni public.
Shalom. Shalom. I'll start with apologizing that my Hebrew is better, okay? So, but I hope your Hebrew is better than my English, but I suppose that not. So I'll speak in English. My parents made Aliyah in 1949, and we were born here in Israel, and they wanted us to speak English at home, but, you know, they heard not English. I brushed my teeth and all those verbs, so therefore they gave up, and they preferred that we'll have a very good Hebrew than a crooked English. So my English is not good enough, but I'll try to do my best. Okay, when I'll speak, you know, I'll include Hebrew words and Arabic words, and everybody will feel convenient. I want to start with three phenomena that I think we have to regard the issue about secular and Orthodox or Zionist religious movement today in Israel, saying, first of all, before those three phenomena, that you can't speak anymore about the secular society. There are a million, approximately, immigrants from the former the former Soviet Union. They're different. They are all the old Israel, as we say. They are different. They are Masorti that are not considered as the Zionist religious. They are different. So you can't speak anymore about the secular. After saying that, I think we can start our discussions mentioning three phenomena. The first one is that they really don't understand us. They don't understand what the hell do we want. I'm not talking about politics. I'm not talking about territories. I'll come to that soon. But first of all, regarding Jewishness, religious life, they remember and they were educated that the Zionist religious movement are part with them, are serving together in the army, are living together, are participating together in ceremonies, are very friendly, very close. Actually, they have the same lifestyle, adding Shabbat, etc. And they are seeing us as a, especially the leaders and especially the rabbis, are becoming more and more extreme, more and more isolated. We cannot be together in ceremonies because Kol Beisha, that's a new thing for 2, 3, 4 years. But since then, Bnei Akiva cannot participate in the ceremony of the town. We can't. We started the issue in the army. We are separated in living areas. If you read this week, Rav Aviner's list about tznius, how should we behave in dress, a big dispute or this big gap is more and more because kashrut issues. We don't anymore see the Rabbanut Rashid kosher enough, so therefore we don't eat. And all those are things. And they are asking us, you could have been our source of Judaism. We could have lived together. We would have come to synagogues if we felt that the synagogues are friendly for us. But they are not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what do you want? What do you want to be? How do you want this state to look like? That's one thing. The second thing is that the Zionist religious movement, and I'll be very careful saying that, is still identified with one issue, and that is Yehuda Veshomron. It's still identified not because this is the reality. I think there is no place that you cannot find Zionist religious people, not in the academic, in courts, in the Knesset, in the army, especially in the army, in culture, in economics, like everywhere except one. I think there's one field that we are far away from that, and that's sports. I don't know exactly why, but that's the situation. But leaving the sports aside, that we are really involved in everything. After saying that, we are still being identified with one issue, and that is Yehuda Veshomron. And when there is such a situation and such an image, you have to ask yourself why. You can blame the whole world. You can blame that they hate us, that they are a threat from us, that they are, you know, everything. So it's their fault. Actually, we are not there. But I can say two things. One thing is in politics. In politics, for the last 40 years, when it came to the point of decisions, making decisions to be part of the coalition or split, or to, first of all, to split, most of the parties of the Zionist religious movement slipped. No, split it. I mean, excuse me, split it. If you remember Morasha, if you remember Hatchia, if you remember Ha'ichud Ha'Leumi, unification, and et cetera, et cetera. And actually, everybody thinks it will be the same in the next Knesset. Yeah, that. And what? Why did they split? They split it because of Eretz Israel. You can't deny that fact. The decisions, if to be part of the coalition or to go to the oppositions, was only one time that it wasn't Yehuda Veshomron. It was, if you remember, the F-16 aircraft that arrived on Shabbos. That was the only situation that something else was there. Even now, if you ask everyone what, I support the new Beit HaYehudi. Don't make any mistakes. But if you ask everyone, what is the flag that the Beit HaYehudi is putting ahead above everything? The real Likud about Eretz Israel, about territories about the Yehuda Shomron, etc., and therefore half, or I don't know how many, of the society in Israel that actually think that Yehuda Shomron is the problem and not the solution, I disagree with them. But half of them feel towards us that we are enemies, or enemies may be too extreme word, but we are not, we cannot be together, live together, and we disagree with you in a very deep place. And that's the second phenomenon. The third thing is the good news. The good, I'm not sure, the good bad news, let's call them that way. More and more people in Israel are not interested anymore in those ideologies and in those disputes and in those, all those issues. There, it's the it started with postmodern circumstances, I'll call it, and today the new age. People are feeling that when they're looking for their own spiritual life, they want to reconnect their Jewish life, their relationship with Hashem, in all kinds of ways. There are hundreds of groups, secular groups that are learning Torah. There are hundreds of groups that are having all kinds of tefillah. There are hundreds, all those issues. I mean, it's a great opportunity. And when we are talking about individual terms and in individuals' ground, and there is a lot of opportunity to reconnect people back to their tradition, leave politics aside, find a way, a solution that everybody will be able to live with. Don't try to force us, and then we will have very good time together. That's, I think, the third phenomenon. Saying those three, now we should decide what to discuss and how to lead the panel, but that's not my job here.
You're busy taking notes, so I think you have something to say. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Tell you something interesting that I discovered recently. I mentioned before I have a think tank in Yerushalayim on political matters. I have political views, and I try to push them. And I have the kind of views that we push. I should just tell you so you understand what it's all about. Are Zionist and libertarian, I guess. Okay. In other words, the idea is to on the one hand, encourage Israel to be a Jewish state in some meaningful way. Okay. And as you know, I have nuanced views about what ways are better than others. But also to encourage freedom of the individual, free markets, and more limited state, and as well as separation of powers between the different branches of government. I don't know if we're going to get taken that far, but the judicial branch in Israel has powers that no judicial branch in any democratic country in the world has, okay? And I'm trying to address that problem. Now, the interesting thing that I want to share with you is this. We occasionally need people to, we need young researchers and so forth. I've got a whole crew of staff that works there, but we put out a call sometimes for young people to come and do whatever. Sometimes I need somebody to make a promotional movie on some topic that we're interested in. Sometimes I need somebody to... The amazing thing I discovered is that almost every single person who walks through the door, these are young people, it's the kind of jobs that young people do, people in their 20s, almost every single person who walks in the door is a datlash, okay? Dati l'shavar, okay? Former dati l'shavar. Ex-dati, okay? People who grew up religious, who went to religious schools, often, went to Mechina or to Hezder, and now come into my office. They're not wearing a kippah, but almost all of them, okay? Now, the question I'm always asking myself is two questions. First of all, why? Okay? And second of all, what does this phenomenon suggest? What's actually going on over here? And what it suggests is the following. It used to be that when people became irreligious, they were rebelling. They were angry. as soon as they became irreligious, they became anti-religious. They became their political views suddenly became Tel Avivi, fashionable Tel Avivi left-wing views, etc. This is no longer the case. Okay, every single person who walks into my office, right, knows that we're a right-wing outfit, to put it simply. Okay, and they come in, they completely identify with a right-wing agenda. They completely identify with a religious agenda. Okay, they understand that we're, the main people working in my office are religious. That our political views are informed by the fact that we're religious. Okay, to a point. Okay, as you know, I have certain views about the limitations of that interaction. But it's a whole new kind of datlash that you've got out there. Okay, and what I. Dati Lisha Avar, okay? It's a whole new brand. They're not rebelling. They're not angry. They're not against religion. On the contrary, they're culturally Jewish and proudly so. They're Jewish in every way.
They want to marry the Tlash, not the secular.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And right. And they want their kids to be datlashim, right? which is a pretty tough trick if you think about it, right? So what's going on in part, okay, is that this whole dichotomy between religious and secular is becoming something like the dichotomy between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. Once upon a time, you were either Ashkenazi or you were Sfardi. There was a very clear dichotomy between them. But it's been three generations already of people intermarrying Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. It's in many cases it's almost completely meaningless now when you ask somebody, are you Ashkenazi or Sfaradi? Well, my mother is this and my father is that, and it doesn't. It's becoming a historical, something of a historical interest. It doesn't really have any real power to it, and I suspect that something very similar is happening to this whole idea of being Dati or being Chiloni. Now, you may find this, either gratifying or very distressing, because if religion is very, very important to you, you don't want to see its boundaries somehow becoming vague and amorphous. But nevertheless, you should understand that it's a fact. This is what's happening. Okay. Now, this has many, many interesting consequences, which I'll be happy to discuss, but let me just address the point that rose now, and if we come back to the other issues, I'll do that later. Politically, what's happening is something very interesting, and that is this. Israel used to consist of the elites, the labor-identified, secular, Ashkenazi, native Israeli, the Achasulim, as some sociologists call them. There was the upper class who ran the country. They took for granted that the country belonged to them, and they still take for granted that the country belongs to them. They feel that they inherited it from their grandparents, and they did inherit it from their grandparents, okay? And they regard other groups, whether it's religious Zionists or Haredim or Arabs or Sfaradim or new immigrants, the whole thing, they're kind of people who are somehow nipping at their heels, trying to steal their country from them, and they're very resentful about it. Now, what's going on now, if you watch carefully, okay, is that the roles are actually becoming reversed. There's such a small minority, the WASPs, okay, they're the equivalent of American WASPs. Now, WASPs in America, we may think of them as somehow running the country, and maybe they are powerful in banking in Philadelphia, but the fact of the matter is that WASPs in America are no longer running the country, okay? That's no longer the case. And it's no longer the case that the secular socialist Ashkenazim are running Israel, okay? But what's interesting is that the Israeli WASPs have suddenly become another sectarian group. They're just another camp like everybody else. The religious Zionists have always been very provincial. We have to get into the government because we have to get money for our yeshivot and we have to do that, right? We have to worry about our institutions. And the WASPs just kind of ran the country, you know. They didn't. But now, suddenly, if you, I'm sure you all noticed that, you know, heard about the social protest, right? The Tzedek Chevrati protest, right? That took place in the summer a year and a half ago. What that was the WASPs deciding, you know what? We're also a group that has to fight for its position in Israel, to fight for its rights and its advantages and privileges. That was simply the WASPs, who used to think of themselves as owning the country and running the country, descending into the position of yet just another camp in the country. And what you see now with the Bayit HaYehudi is the exact opposite thing going on. Bayit HaYehudi in the days of Borg and Hammer and Orlev and company, they were just strictly a sectarian party. Their job was to get money for yeshivot, et cetera, et cetera. That's the way they thought, even if they occasionally wandered into other issues. But that's the way they thought of themselves. The Mafdal is now polling at 13 to 15 seats, primarily because Bennett doesn't project that image anymore. Okay, the image that he projects is, yes, I have different views about the country, okay? I happen to be a little bit more right-wing than Likud. He's not a socialist, as the Maftal always was, simply because they schlepped after the Labor Party. He's projecting an image of somebody who's actually interested in the general issues that are of interest and importance to the country.
So let me just clarify what you're all saying and move it a bit forward. So both of you seem to be arguing that the old easy dichotomies that people made between a dati public and a chiluni public, we can say, if not completely broken down, have become infinitely more complicated, that there's more complex strands in the body politic. But this leads to, I guess, the next stage. The next stage is actually what are, say, we'll use this for just term of convenience, chiluni Israelis looking for religiously. What sort of role can the Dati Lumi community play in this? Should they play a role, right? And I'm going to break this down into two sections, and then Rabbi Natav, I'll ask you to comment. One is on an official role. I know that Sohar does many marriages, right, which is a kind of official thing where you get contact with chilunim and you're actually performing a very important service. The other is subtler, just what sort of influence religiously should this community have, or should they have any influence at all? In other words, because I've actually met chilonim, I've gone to Alma in Tel Aviv and seen what they do there, whose attitude is actually, leave us alone. We want spirituality, but we'll get it on our own terms, in our own institutions, and actually whenever you get involved, whether it's Haredim or Dati Lumi, you mess it up. And all we want is to be left alone. In other words, they may be, the divisions may be lessening, but it's not necessarily the same thing as saying there's a kind of easy rapprochement or some sort of connection between the two. So I'm wondering if all of you can comment on what's actually going on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I heard that comment also in a very unusual scenario. There used to be an organization called Dusiach, which actually grew out of the Rabin assassination, where some people felt it was time that society was unraveling, it was time for religious and non-religious to get together. So I was a little bit involved in that organization, and I remember being shocked by one of the Chiloni board members of the Dusiach that our interest is in you leaving us alone, and we're coming to meet with you on how that can be done. So that was a bit striking. It was a breath of fresh air or something different. But I think part of the problem is that there's walls that have been built up, what Rav Sherlo alluded to before, in terms of the increasing division on a demographic and residential and cultural level, where societies, and there are important reasons why religious society has made the move to prefer living within its own quarters, and I respect that. I mean, I know that we live in fairly religious situations. Be that as it may, I think that there's an imperative on people who are concerned about Klal Israel, and I think that we as religious Jews tend to forget that, partly because of our ghetto existence, and often need to be shocked out of it. And for good or for bad, all sorts of political events often force us to make that realization. Unfortunately, it's occasionally too little too late. I remember there was a program called Panim El Panim, which was also in response to an event, and that was the imminent withdrawal from the Gush Katif, which was religious people, often yeshiva students and the like, to go out to different neighborhoods, Chiloni neighborhoods, simply knock on their doors, introduce themselves, and show them that we're human, that there's, you know, introducing a human dimension. And it was quite successful from what I understand, but again, it was much too little, much too late. And unfortunately, as soon as the Hitnatkut, I haven't heard about Panim al Panim since that occurred. I mean, it could be it's still around, but certainly not in the proportions that it had been organized for that specific event. I think that we have to make interaction, we meaning the religious community, if we're concerned about Kalal, if we're concerned about bringing Jewish values and Jewish identity, and being a resource for the search, the spiritual search that is more common to more Israelis, and that could be a high-level spiritual search where there's a serious looking for meaning, or more commonly, middle-class couples who simply want some sort of Jewish identity for their children. The issue is we're not around for simple reason that we're not living in the same neighborhoods, we're not going to the same events, number one. And number two, what Rav Shalom mentioned, the notion of you don't need to get involved, we'll do it on our own. So we have to be willing to participate in that. You know, as I was just at the Limud conference in the United Kingdom, which is a fascinating model for that, and it's controversial in the United Kingdom for the same reasons I'm sure it would be controversial here. And that is that it's not under Orthodox auspices. And within that, you have a lot of people who are willing to explore and were coming to my sessions, and Professor Capel was there also. They were coming to our sessions. People would not come to our yeshivot or seminaries or, you know, program like this. We're coming, and we have to be more open to that, I think, again, if we're aware of our responsibility and our opportunity, really, to reach out, because I think they do, in general, whenever I'm in conversation with non-religious Jews, whether it be in Israel, whether it be outside of Israel, they often look to anyone with a kippah, certainly if you have a beard and a kippah, it's an even higher level. They look to us as experts, and they're interested in our perspective, and they're willing to ask questions, but quite often it has to be on their turf. And I think in a pluralistic society, which willy-nilly, that's what we have to be ready to push that move on a wider level, whether it be in Great Britain, which is a lot of discussion about it, but in Israel also.
So this raises a larger question, which I'll throw out to all of you. That model, the Limud model, my wife and I have also spoken at 3 Limud conferences, and it's a remarkable model, exactly as Rabbi Nataf indicated, because you're talking about a situation where they do their best to satisfy the minimum religious requirements of everybody, so the food is all kosher, and there are different minyanim of different sort of denominational stripes. But the one unifier, which really is the unifier of the Jewish people, is Limud HaTorah. So in other words, you can have all sorts of people presenting all sorts of sessions at the same time or together. But what does this entail? This entails, on a certain level, a benefit and a risk. Right, the benefit is obvious, that you get Jews breaking down the walls of sort of division and learning together. From the religious perspective, I don't personally believe this, but this is what I hear of a lot, is the risk, or to use a more nefarious word, the contamination, right? Which is the idea that, you know, my children, they got together with these children, or, you know, and they heard other ideas. It's a little bit Orwellian because it's kind of vague. I don't want that. And they're actually getting influence, and then you lead to Professor Capel's ideal, which is Dat Lashim marrying other Dat Lashim and so on. I want you to talk about benefit versus risk. I want you to talk about if it really means to engage with the Chilani public, and I agree with you, it in many ways has to be on their turf or at best a neutral turf. How do you do that and maintain
I'll rehearse the argument. How do you maintain the religious integrity and character of your own? Is it too big a price to pay? And so on. Maybe we can start with Rav Shurlo and move along.
I'll behave like an Israeli. I'll speak about what I want to speak. And I'll say the following. The limud, and I think, I don't want to make a mistake that will make a mistake and concentrate on the limud or only on the intellectual level. There is a small percentage of people that are really interested in speaking and having a real dialogue, learning together, exchanging ideas together, etc., is very important for them. And then we can speak there on the issues, what should be the common environment, risk and benefits, and all those ideas. But if we are talking here, if we are talking about Klal Israel, so we have also to think about the entire Jewish nation, that most of them are not related into limud, into discussions, and so they want something, they want to live in a Jewish state, if we're talking about Israel, and I'll say one word about the United States soon. Saying that, so even though I prefer being in limud, in discussions, in dialogues, and all those issues, but we should think about a completely different paradigm, because we can't, you don't want to speak only with the elite or with the new white Ashkenazi somehow. You want to speak with the entire nation. You want to have a connection with the entire nation. For instance, art and the singers and all those events are much more powerful and are much more important for people. Books, that's one thing, culture. The second thing is lifestyle. Like Tzohar, for instance, yeah, weddings and bar mitzvahs and Brit Milah and their birthdays and mezuzah and Shabbos and all those issues that are very important for the entire state of Israel. I think there should be three steps, or at least I'm not sure these are the three steps. I can say it's actually your former question. I think the three very important things we should know. One, the biggest wall is because the secular and the whole secular, the only thing I can say about the secular field is the fact that they are being forced. Once you are being forced, so your respond is, you know, to step ahead and to say, I don't want it. And the fact that we are trying to force, I don't know what will be, how can we do things without laws, without legislations, without the constitution, whatever. But everything that we are trying to force will be very problematic, because I think people, first of all, feel today that they want freedom of choice and freedom of expression and freedom of everything. And that's the monopoly that we have as rabbis, that from one hand I want it, I support it, I want it. From the other hand, I do agree that it's a very, very big problem. It's something that we have to discuss from the beginning, and even our children that became the Tlashim, one of the reasons are because we are trying to use power, and using power is something that the respond is against. From the other hand, I'm very honest, I don't want to be to say wrong things. It's also it's not a conflict, it's a dilemma that I myself debating. I can understand that when there is a law, let's say, for Jewish marriage, so actually it causes that many, many couples are getting married in a Jewish wedding, that if there will be no law, maybe much less of them will do that. So it's but we have to discuss it from the beginning. The second thing is a real dialogue. It's not only that we are coming to teach them as experts. A real dialogue means, in Israel there's a Shaikh Ophir, I don't know if you remember him, he had a show that was a Arabic English teacher that is trying to teach Hamlet, the 11th grade. And one of the sentences was, what's the difference between a monologue and a dialogue? A monologue is when one person speaks to himself. The dialogue is when two persons speak to themselves. Yeah, so that's in Israel. And if we want to have something that is, you should have a real dialogue. Because once you're coming to sit together to a kind of limud, whatever, but you know everything, and actually it's a trick to grab them into be a keiruv project. So therefore, people don't want that the approach towards them will be that they should be mekarev. If you will listen, if you will adapt, if you will even admit, you don't have even to admit, admit that there is a contribution that you get out of this dialogue, that's, I think, the second condition. The third condition is that actually, I think that's that maybe the biggest wall today, I'm not talking now about the forcing, but the biggest wall is that we should make it do, have an internal discussion, first of all, and that is the approach or the attitude towards the akhir, the stranger. Because I'll say it very briefly. I can give a long lecture about it, but I think that in the 19th century, the main discussion in the Jewry was about nationality, about identification. The Enlightenment, the Tumat HaSkala, whatever. In the 20th century, this discussion was about nationality, and now it's about the different. The different is the Gentile, the women, the everyone that is not me. I mean, the homosexual, the whatever, or everyone that is not me. And actually, we don't have good answers. We don't have good answers to freedom of choice, to people that are deciding to live in a different way of living. We don't have we didn't discuss our dream, our vision about the Palestinians. I'm not talking about reality. I'm talking about our vision. What do you want that things will happen? We even didn't discuss what will happen if we will be 80% of the population and there will be only 20% secular people here. I'm not in theory. What is our opinions? And unless we do that, I think we can't solve the main discussions that are taking place today in the whole world and especially in Israel.
I can't help but be struck by the level of contradiction that arises by this. You made three points. One is we can't coerce them. We need to have a genuine dialogue with them. And we need to reflect on the other. All of these are, to me, unassailable, irrefutable points. But think about them one by one. So let's begin with coercion. In a society, you make a decision, so you decide on what level are you going to coerce people, right? So you begin with the first point, which was made in political theory, probably made best by Thomas Hobbes, which is that you coerce people because if you don't coerce them, they're going to kill you, right? So if you have two people and there's one coconut and they're on an island, so if they don't split it, if one person grabs the coconut and says, I grab it because I can kill you, I'm stronger than you, so then the third party, the government, which he called Leviathan, has to step in and say, no, I'm sorry, I'm taking power away from both of you because otherwise I must coerce you here, otherwise the stronger is always going to kill the weaker. So that we call that necessary coercion. The question is, and we go back to me, the pork example, right? We talked this morning about whether, you know, the state of Israel should enforce laws about whether a butcher in Holon can sell pork. So it's either or, right? Otherwise, you're taking away the person's freedom.
Depends what will be the process. The process can be politics, trying to fight, and the one that will have the power will take everything. But the discourse can be completely different, like Gabizon-Medan Treaty. I'm not talking about the treaty itself. But saying one thing, first of all, we want to come to an agreement, okay? And saying that we'll sit together and find the way. Actually, there are many, it had been done many times in Israel in specific laws. Like, it was a very controversial law about Chok HaCholei HaNote Lamut, brain death and whatever. And the Knesset decided we'll not discuss it in politics. We'll establish or create a committee that professionals and people that are not, don't have to go to primaries next week, we'll discuss it, and they'll come back with a good decision to the Knesset, and the Knesset will vote. But changing the discourse and take the, and the process of making agreement, saying that we are looking, we're not looking for the way to win. We're looking for the best agreement and compromises that will make together is a different language, and it was done already. That's what I'm claiming.
How does that fit Jewishly? In other words, wasn't Judaism always traditionally a kind of top-down? It's saying to you, you know, this is the truth, this is halacha, right? So how do you alter that picture?
Wasn't it, wasn't, didn't we have a, the wide, wide, wide range of Am Haaretz status? That the approach towards Am Haaretz was completely different? We did have it. I mean, I claim that we have very deep in our traditions, not only the Beit Sheni, even, I'm not talking about Tanakh, I have a lot to say about Tanakh, but even in Beit Sheni, the decision was made not to force.
But that doesn't actually work with your second point. Your second point was genuine horizontal dialogue where each side is actually mutually respectful. Chazal's model of the Am Haaretz is not this model.
Okay. Right. Okay. So that's the second. Now I can start a second point. But I'll leave
granted, Chazal believed, I believe, in religious coercion, whether they were speaking to themselves or to Am Haaretz or different levels of what was expected. But as you said, it seems to me that, first of all, we are living in a different reality. That's, it's important to acknowledge that, that the multicultural state is something that is a different creature than what we had in classical times, whether we're the majority or whether we're the minority. In fact, instead of within our society, I think we have to work more on consensus and compromise than on majority takes all. I think that's what needs to be understood in the political forum. I think further down in the informal capacity, you mentioned formal and informal, there has to be more willingness to, in fact, engage in dialogue on all sorts of levels. I remember a critique of Gesher, which is a fine organization, the Gesher being an outreach organization. Obviously, we all know Gesher means bridge, and the complaint on the Chiloni side was it was a one-way bridge. It only had one direction that was meant to bring Chilonim to understand Datiim, but not vice versa. I think that willingness to listen and willingness to admit that we don't have all the answers, that religious Judaism never was meant to be absolute truth that knows all the answers. I mean, I think Chazal engage in discussion, in machloket, in trying to push the boundaries of knowledge, dealing with new issues, as Rav Sherlau alluded to. All these things have to be done with a new spirit. If we're interested, again, in Klal, if we're interested only in addressing narrow interests, and there is such a model that the best interest of Judaism is simply to infuse the committed, those people who are really going to survive Jewishly, and simply to focus on that group, and certainly something that I think was promoted in the Haredi world and largely still is promoted in that world. And the dilution, I mean, you spoke about contamination. I'm not sure that that's the issue as much as dilution, that by focusing our energies on Klal as opposed to focusing our energies on the inner community, ultimately is a waste of those precious energies and resources that we have. And that's the issue that that the larger Orthodox community has to address and make decisions upon.
Yeah, okay. I don't disagree with anything that either of my predecessors
said. Wow, really? No kidding.
I'm in trouble.
Yeah, you are in trouble. You are, it's the first time this ever happened, by the way. Okay, but let me just, you know, with regard to this, I just say the same thing, but from my own personal perspective. In my professional capacity as a professor of computer science, I mean, I deal with Chilonim on a personal level and with non-Jews on a personal level all the time, okay? And I have perfectly natural relationships with them, okay? It's perfectly ordinary. I mean, we talk about all kinds of professional matters or personal matters such as arise. I never think of myself as somehow being the representative of religious Jewry, you know, and this whole business of Kiruv, and I have to tell you, I mean, this is it creeps me out personally, okay, because the idea of entering into a dialogue with a person in which I presumably am representing one side of a dialogue, I'm putting on my hat as the official representative of Orthodox Jewry, and now my job is to somehow persuade him to become more like me, right? I mean, it's not like I don't know how. I can't do it, okay? I'm just not capable of having what is essentially, by definition, an inauthentic conversation with somebody. You're asking me to be speaking to him not authentically, but rather for a particular purpose, right? That I actually want to get out of this conversation a particular result. I can't do it, okay? I can't.
Do you think it is a worthy task, or in other words?
Yeah, it's a worthy task for people who can do it. I can't do it.
But you're saying that it's inauthentic, so why would it be a worthy task for anyone to be inauthentic?
Well, I don't want to judge others, okay? Maybe other people are capable of doing it authentically because their convictions are such that's what they would authentically do when they engage somebody in dialogue. I personally have two views that make it impossible for me to do it, which other people may not share. One is my general views about religious belief and so on are extremely quirky and eccentric, okay? On the other hand...
What we hadn't noticed.
Yeah. My views about religion itself are extremely old-fashioned and conservative, okay? So that the last thing I'm going to do is enter a dialogue and say all kinds of things with a straight face because I feel obligated to do so as a representative of traditional Judaism that I personally don't believe, okay? For me, it would be inauthentic. People whose personal convictions are better aligned with what they think religion should be might be able to do this authentically. I can't. Okay, my religious view is that religion is very, you know, is not feminist, it's not gay friendly, it's not a lot of things, and you should be believing all kinds of things, okay? I don't believe all of those things that I think you should believe, and I'm not going to, I therefore am incapable of telling somebody else to believe it because I don't. On the other hand, I'm incapable of telling them that they should not believe it because I think it's important to believe those things, okay? So for me, any such dialogue...
So we need a scorecard here to keep track.
Any such dialogue would be inauthentic. So for me, Kiruv is just a non-starter. It can't happen. On the other hand, I can have perfectly happy, open relationships with Goyim and non-religious Jews, and presumably, if they see me to be a decent, integrated human being, they'll be sufficiently impressed that it'll... That they'll be more friendly towards the point of view that they regard me as representing.
Look, I actually think there's no doubt that probably the best way of people changing is through the most natural, organic interactions, right? Everybody knows in their life if they met a religious person and it wasn't non-formal, it wasn't they're preaching to you, they're not teaching you, they're just wonderful. And you're so struck by their wonderfulness, by their honesty, by their decency, by their compassion, by their integrity. This is bound to leave. Gemara says, right, in Yuma, right? Woe unto us if you're a corrupt person, and woe unto your father, and woe unto your teacher, right? So Chazal understood that the most impressive thing as a person is not what they're necessarily formally going to learn in a school, but if you're a dati person and you are the very paradigm of saintliness, that's going to leave a measure on another person. The problem is that we're talking about a kind of communal, public, national thing where you don't always have the time, the luxury to be able to model one person at a time that beauty, that would be wonderful. So I again return to the issue of basically, let's frame it in the largest possible way. Are we talking about two incompatible value systems? And for the sake of argument, I will lay them out in a polar way. One value system is vertical, hierarchical, truth-based. We are Judaism. We are the truth. The fact that you don't have the truth, I feel bad for you, I may pity you, but I certainly don't delude myself into thinking this is a genuine discourse where I can learn from you. As one rabbi once said to me, it's all very nice to talk about dialogue, but what am I actually going to learn from them?
you know, I'm going to learn about Beethoven, right? So, look, again, that's not my view, but I understand the mentality there, which is that Torah is truth. And, like, if you're going to tell me that secularism or relativism is something I should learn from, you're crazy, right? So that's one point of view. On the other hand, what we're espousing here, which sounds very noble, is this idea that, you know, we need to meet in a genuine and respectful way, not one way. You've all used synonyms of the same notion, and I'm still trying to understand how does this notion genuinely work given the framework of the first thing, right? What Judaism seems to say all the time. How do we make that? How does this actually get bridged? Go ahead.
I think one of the problems that exists in Kiruv or in dialogue is the meeting of unequal forces. And as I think it's generally, the most learned rabbis have a lot to learn in terms of general culture, in terms of the context, the intellectual context. I mean, Rav Kook, we spoke about before, was one of the few rabbis that appreciated the intellectual context within which he was speaking. I think most people have no idea. I mean, Mark Shapiro makes the point that most Rosh Yeshiva have no idea of Jewish philosophy. They've never even read Mor Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. So to be arrogant enough is to say, I know it all, and there's nothing that the other person can, you know, I am Judaism, even if you were to come from the position that Judaism on some level is imminently and absolutely true, and that secular culture at best is some sort of adornment to Torah, even if one wants to come from that position, that doesn't transfer that the individual rabbi, the individual Jew, is coming from that position of the know-it-all, who's completely aware of the context and so on and so forth. That being said, a lot of times the dialogue on the individual level can be between people who have absolutely no background in anything and someone who has some background, and that creates an uneven dialogue in any situation. I'm not sure how to create an honest dialogue in that situation. Why should I respect an Amaretz in a Jewish dialogue? Why should I respect someone with very little background philosophically who's never thought about great issues in a larger context? I think on some level what a model that is appropriate is to speak on that rabbis should be speaking to professors and that laymen should be speaking to laymen where the level of dialogue is the same, wherein the discussion can be more authentic. Whether it's actually more truthful is another question, more real. But I think a lot of the problems start when, you know, certain Kiruv organizations, I heard someone referring to potential customers as ripe fruit. As you know, someone who is you know, they don't know anything, and they're looking. So I can snatch them. So that on some level to me is problematic. On the other hand, you know, they are Jewish souls. How do you approach them in an authentic way? I mean, I think we've spoken about this before. The more mass approach of an organization like Esh HaTorah, which says, okay, they're out there, and otherwise they're not going to be Jewish. However we can get them, let's do it. I don't have an answer to that because this is a real issue.
Questions from the floor? Yeah. Okay. So we're going to throw it up to the floor.
Hi, I'm Jeremy. I'm from Philly. Do you think Israeli society would be better off if the majority of the Jewish population had a higher level of religious identity or observance?
On the T-shirt of my yeshiva, the Bachurim wrote one of my famous titles, and that is a framework that doesn't guarantee anything. It's an opportunity. That means the worst place in Israel, if you know a little bit Tanakh, was the Mishkan on Eli's days and his son at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. And the fact that they were in the Mishkan, they were Kohanim in the Mishkan, was a very good opportunity, but not an insurance company, and not, you can't take it for granted. So saying that, I'll answer your question. I do believe that it's very important, and I'm even more extreme than Moshe, that everyone should observe, that the Yehudi should observe mitzvot, and it's very important that people will be Jewish and be committed to the mitzvot and the Torah to everything. If this will make the Israeli society better, tzadikim yilchu bam ufoshim yikashlu bam. It can be a great opportunity. It can be a disaster, because you can be a very, very, strict in halacha, and a very bad guy. So therefore, it's not automatically. I see that as a very good opportunity, but not as a direct decision that will enhance or promote the state of Israel.
My name is Jonathan Lieberman. I'm from Manchester, England. Slowly. Okay. I was a little bit disappointed as the discussion ensued. You began by saying that the religious Zionist community needed to look at itself, and suddenly we switched over to how we can influence the secular community. I understood the title to be, how does the secular community view the Dati Leumi? And I'd like to just demonstrate a problem with a little personal story. My son... it's 2 minutes. It's not even that, half a minute. It's an important point. My son is currently in the army, serving in Shechem. And he comes back and tells me that the biggest problem that they have is the religious, and he's a religious boy, the religious Zionist community causing them the biggest trouble. Now, you mentioned the Yehuda v'Shomron problem. How is it possible that the religious Zionist community can dissociate itself in the eyes of the secular public from the, inverted commas, extremism that it views? That was the question that you posed at the beginning. I'm interested to hear the answer to the question.
If I had known, I would have done it. So I don't know the answer, okay? I know only one thing, that it's very important for us to do that. I mean, to play the game according to the rules of democracy, of law, of decisions, of accepting orders, it's very important for us. I'm not talking about... if we want to pursue or could convince the majority in Israel to see Yehuda v'Shomron as the solution, not as the problem, it's very important to adopt the idea of playing according to the rules. And if we'll not do that, we may win. We may win if we'll have a lot of power. But the chances that we lose, or the chances that the price of winning will be too expensive, is so dangerous that I prefer playing according to the rules.
Can I just add to your question, which I thought was a very sharp question? Is there an internal discussion that's taking place seriously within the Dati Leumi community, among the rabbinate or the lay people, as to these issues? In other words, that we need to get our house in order. We need to take stock. Especially on the rabbinic level, I'm struck because our mutual friend, Yoel Finkelman, wrote an article, and the title was, What Were the Rabbis Thinking? And the article, which was in the Jerusalem Post last year, was about the fact that Rav Avineri and others sent out a letter bemoaning the prosecution of Moshe Katsav, and it was a very sort of sharp letter, basically demeaning the judicial process, calling it biased and so on. And when you read about that kind of thing, you wonder, like, is there an internal cheshbon that's going on in the Dati Leumi community that would not lead to the outcomes that this gentleman is talking about?
It depends when do you. If you would have asked me 2 years ago, I would answer no. We are split it. We are separated. There's the Kav and the anti-Kav and all those issues. And actually, there's no real discussions. Lately, things are changing. There is, for instance, there is a rabbinical forum in the internet, very close one. I mean, it's only for people that's registered. About approximately 300 rabbis. You could read about it. You read about it a few times now lately. And it's open space and freedom of freely expression, no fear and no leaks. And there you find this kind of discussions. Things are changing slowly. The problem is that the most of the rabbis that are participating in those conversations insist that the public will not know anything about that. They don't want to, they want to, you know, to have freedom of expression means for them not to pay the price of publishing or advertising their opinions. I know personally, I pay a very high price because I disagree with this. Okay, but I know that many, many rabbis support my opinions, but they will not dare say it loudly.
Can I say something on that? Okay, I want to take a dissenting view on this, if I may. There are two separate issues. One is, we have problems within the religious Zionist community that we have an interest in dealing with simply because every community has an interest in dealing with problems within. But if I understood the question that was being asked is, what are you doing to make sure that more extreme people or people with different views in your community aren't making a bad impression on people, okay? I reject the implicit assumptions behind that question. If you were to say to a black leader in the United States, well, what are you doing about black crime? You know, white people really don't like black people because black people do all kinds of bad things. You know, the crime rate among blacks is much higher than it is among whites. Are you doing anything about that? Because whites really don't like it when they see people doing that kind of stuff. You would say, you know, that's really racist, okay? I'm not, you know, one black isn't responsible for all the other blacks in the country. And if people think that the actions of particular ones reflect on others, well, then it's their problem, not my problem. I think the same thing here. If you don't like what people in Yitzhar are doing, you know, so disagree with the people in Yitzhar, okay? Don't tell me that I have a problem as a religious Zionist that I have to go solve, okay? I might choose to do that anyway of my own volition because I think it's important within the community, but I don't feel an obligation to make sure that everybody in my community makes a good impression on people outside that community.
Senator.
Eric from New Jersey. I guess it's generally posed to everyone. Maybe like Riley Turlow mentioned a little bit more about it, but I want to frame it in a different. Most of the discussion was about secularism versus Dati. So I want to also frame like the issue, I guess, with Haredi versus Dati. Like I've heard that like a Haredi rather sit with a secular and a Dati rather sit with a secular instead of like sitting together. So a lot of the answer was let's have discussions, let's try to work together, maybe Kirov. Coming, I guess, maybe from a Haredi standpoint, does that mean that if they would try to solve the problem with Haredi versus Dati, should they do Kirov on us? Should they, like, have, like, if we're looking for the answer going, let's say, I'm not saying one's better, let's say there are three stages. We're saying stage one to stage two, you have to do something. Does that mean from stage two to stage three, you also have to do the same thing? And we wouldn't want people, like, having Kirov on us, so how do we solve this issue?
I really think that we should be Mikarev the Haredim too. It's not a joke, because I'm not sure I understood everything. I said in advance that my English is not good enough. But I disagree with the scale, you know, secular, Zionist religious, and Haredi. That's not my scale. My scale is, if there is a scale, secular, Haredi, Zionist religious.
Okay, my name's Vivian Simonoff. I currently earn Parnosa in Hutz Laretz in Manchester, like these good people. But my heart and my family, my children, my grandchildren live here. I think I address this question really to my new friend sitting here at the end. I like a bit of rebellion. I like the fact that you don't think you're authentic because you are the real thing. I think it's very important when you speak to young people, particularly when you speak to unaffiliated young people, that you don't assume that they only want one answer. because why are the unaffiliated any different than we are? We don't all want one answer. We're not all speaking with one voice. And I think the most important thing when we talk about Kirov is that we show people how we live. Yeah, my question is really kind of how that all got lost. Why are we forgetting that young people are just the same as we old people?
To me? Don't know.
Thank you for the comment. I'll think on it.
One more down there. One more over here.
It's me again. I was actually talking about this with a guy in yeshiva the other day, and we noticed that in Judaism, different groups within Judaism define themselves not necessarily by what they are, but by the other groups that they're not. Like you see, Reform just came about by saying we're not Orthodox. Orthodox then said we're not Reform. Haredi said we're not Orthodox or Reform. The Dati Lumi come about saying we're not the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox, and we're not the seculars. The seculars say we're not the Dati Lumi or the Haredi. So what I was really asking is, how do you think that these have come about, and do you think it's healthy to be defined by what you're not rather than what you are, or if even there is anything that they are not, then they're all the same thing?
You have to ask a psychiatrist. I mean, I mean, that's probably naturally that whenever I teach, you know, when I teach the first sentence of the Mishnah, Matai Korin et Shema Be'arvit, I'm asking, my first question is, what are the options? I mean, that's the way of thinking. I don't want to defend the fact that we are always identifying ourselves by saying, who are we not? I understand the question, but from the other hand, you must understand that this is one of the best way of thinking. Because when you read Matai Korin et Shema Be'arvit, so you ask, what are the options? And it can be, when you go to sleep, or Tzeta Kochavim, or 3 hours, Mishetichle Regel Minashuk, or whatever. And then when you have the options, your decisions are much more valuable, are much more, you understand them more. So we use the fact that we are not him or there as a instrument, as a skill that we have. But otherwise, you are right. I mean, otherwise we should tell ourselves, okay, we're using this way of thinking by saying, who are we not? But without having a positive identity, saying who we are, we are doing a wrong thing. Now, why do people think that way? As I said, you don't have to ask us. You have to ask professionals understanding humanity or human being thinking.
I'm Shimi Kandel. I go to RSSV from LA. My question is, so being that we are all religious Zionists, I guess we'd all agree.
Except for
Dr. Capel. We'd all agree that we want some aspect of religion in our government. So, and as for the religious doctrine of the religious Zionist movement, we believe that we can induce our own redemption, so that we can, by being here, we can then cause Mashiach to come, or we can cause our own redemption, essentially. So at what point can we, to what extent should we include halacha in our government, and then be able to say, Icon, we can now accept, you know, we can now expect Mashiach to come, or is there...
Who knows?
I mean, or should we just, you know, say we have this much and we have to leave it as such and then wait for Mashiach to come, or do we just keep adding more and more halacha into our government?
I'll say my answer. Everything that I said and do I think is not related to the fact if Mashiach will come or not. Mashiach will come or not, it's his decision or Hashem's decision. I would have done the same thing even without redemption, without Geula, without even though I grew up and I'm I'm part of it. I do believe that Eretz Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael is part of the Geula. But the decisions that were spoken, at least in this session and the session that was before, are not really related to the question if it's a Geula or Mashiach or whatever. These are decisions that, let's say that now there will come a Navi, a prophet, and will say that the Mashiach will come in 2,000 years. I will not lose anything in my faith in Mashiach, and I will not change anything in my decisions regarding what we spoke here. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I'm frightened. I just agreed with you again.
Okay.
We're going to leave it at that. And thank you very much.